Hello and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear about Gary's Powers & Sons Construction from Stephen Lattimore. Nick Jansen reports on how environment groups say that EPA cuts will damage Hoosier health. And Chris Nolte talks with Senator Melton Wednesday, August 2nd on Regionally Speaking about the new Gary Schools Emergency Manager. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Planned Parenthood in Maryville is able to provide abortions again after halting those services for a couple of weeks. The clinic in northwestern Indiana suspended abortions earlier this month because a doctor has severed ties with the center. That put them in violation of an Indiana law that requires abortion centers to have agreements with doctors who have admitting privileges at local hospitals. Planned Parenthood was able to find another physician to sign that backup agreement. The Department of Health notified the clinic Monday, August 1st, it could resume its abortion services. In a statement, Planned Parenthood of Indiana and Kentucky President and CEO Christy Gillespie said the organization is committed to providing a wide range of services, including abortion. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A Gary company is being recognized for their success. The Powers & Sons Construction Company is being recognized by Black Enterprise Magazine as the 2017 Company of the Year. Stephen Lattimore took a look at the Gary company being highlighted as one of the best in the country.
His father, Mamon Sr., began his career in Natchez, Mississippi, building homes and churches in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Like so many others, he brought his family north for the promise of a better future. He settled in Gary and for 12 years worked for Andrew Means, building projects like Means Manor. In 1958, Mamon Powers Sr. started Powers Construction. He partnered with Holly Winters. And in 1967, he branched off and founded Powers & Sons Construction. The first major commercial project was the Salvation Army at 11th and Grant. Their resume also includes the Railcat Stadium in downtown Gary.
Yeah, it was a great project, a great opportunity. Probably wasn't our most challenging project. There are projects that you do along the way that really make a difference, and certainly that was a great opportunity. Probably our most challenging project was building the tunnels at O'Hare. If you recall how O'Hare is structured, there's a parking garage and there are tunnels that go from the parking garage over to the terminals. But we had the opportunity to build one of those tunnels for pedestrians and for mechanical purposes, and that was probably clearly our most challenging project at that time, and maybe even still today. And it was a real learning experience for us. That one jumps out. The convention center, our first convention center in Indianapolis, was about 160,000 square foot addition that we were able to build for the city of Indianapolis. We actually had the opportunity to implode Market Square Arena. Implosion is when you demolish a building by dynamiting it, and so we learned the process for implosion and how that all works, and making sure that when the building does collapse from the explosion, if you will, that it actually implodes and goes in rather than out.
More projects followed, each one of them a monument to his family's entrepreneurial spirit. Mamon Powers Jr. was lucky to have a good example set by his father and others.
I was always around African-American entrepreneurs. Literally, our father never had a job. He always was in business or was a vice president for Means Developers. And I watched Andrew Means as a builder build subdivisions that people were very proud to live in the 40s and 50s, and got to learn later on how he accomplished that. Because to be able to accomplish that feat when most African-Americans couldn't get mortgages, and how do you finance the land to be able to make all this happen? The genius that it took to accomplish that is really quite amazing. It's quite a story how he was able to make all of that happen. And so I marvel at how they accomplished things with much less opportunity than we have today. And that always became my motivation, that they did more with less, and what's your problem? Why can't you do more with more? And so that became my motivation.
Today, Powers & Sons Construction has 70 team members in offices in Indianapolis, Chicago, and here in Gary. Since 1974, Powers has been on the Black Enterprise list of 100 top black businesses in the country. This year, they've been named the Company of the Year. To put it into perspective, it's kind of like being featured in Ebony or Jet magazine for African Americans. It's a confirmation that you've made it.
So I think they perhaps looked at that longevity and decided to select us as Company of the Year for 2017. So it was a total surprise when they called and said that they wanted to bestow that honor upon us, which was one that it is a great honor. And again, we were just totally shocked. Because again, when you're in the midst of just trying to run a business and survive from day to day, sometimes you don't think about what others see on the outside.
Chuck Hughes is executive director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce.
Where African Americans lived in Gary at the time, the more prominent areas were built by Powers and their partner Winters. So they've been around for a long time. And they've won various other awards as well, but to be designated as Business of the Year by Black Enterprise, that's a huge accomplishment. And they have been a company that we have pointed to for a long time because they've hired a lot of local people over the years, and they've been a source of pride to us in the community.
Over all these years, Powers has learned some tough lessons, like how important it is not to grow too large too fast.
I think the biggest mistake that I've made and others can avoid, it gets back to what I talked about. One, stay focused on what your business objective is. Don't think that you can be everything for everybody. So if your mission is to, as I said, build houses, you know, stick to building houses and make sure you build them well before you start to do something else that's different. And you'll get tempted, and we get tempted all the time, to look at other opportunities outside of our core business. And I've just found it's better to stay with our core business. Once you have a little success, don't let that success go to your head, because you can be history just as quickly as you can be deemed successful.
So what does the future hold? Well, the next big project they're hoping for will be on Chicago's South Side, and it bears the name of Chicago's favorite son, Barack Obama.
Well, I guess I can say at this point probably the most exciting project that we're pursuing right now is the presidential library, the Obama Library. Yeah, that's probably the most exciting thing that we're pursuing. So it's in the very early stages, but it is, I guess, public information that we are, along with, you know, we put together a team to pursue that. And I know there's nothing that anyone else can build that we can't build. And so we've tried to impart that same type of motivation and passion with them, that anything anybody else can do, we can do, and we're just as smart as they are. Matter of fact, we're probably a little smarter, so, because we're still here.
In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Indiana stands to lose out if Congress approves proposed budget cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, says environmentalists, scientists, EPA staffers, and Indiana residents. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen has more on the story.
A congressional subcommittee last month passed an 8% across-the-board cut to the EPA's 2018 budget. Michael Mikulka is an EPA employee and president of a local chapter of the Government Employees Union. He says those cuts are bad news for Hoosiers.
The general public should not be surprised to see increases in contamination from heavy metals like lead and an increase in cancer rates.
The budget would also reduce the amount of loan money available to states for water infrastructure projects. According to the state, Indiana needs $2 billion in immediate water infrastructure repairs. Valparaiso University chemistry professor Julie Peller says the cuts would shift enforcement and cleanup responsibilities to the states.
Our state is simply not equipped to deal with these types of problems.
The congressional plan is far less drastic than the 31% cut proposed by President Trump. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Kids are returning to school this month, and according to the National Summer Learning Association, about 9 out of 10 teachers will spend as much as 3 weeks on review because of summer learning loss. WBAA's and IPBS's Charlotte Tuggle reports that something school districts and libraries continually try to fight with academic programs.
Dauntless. You have to find the flag.
That's Maggie Pinnock. She's one of the teen service librarians at the Frankfort Community Public Library. She's running through an obstacle course based on the Divergent series of young adult books that's been set up between bookshelves. It's part of a lock-in, an end-of-the-summer party for those who did enough book reports while school was out. Ninth grader Haley Cook, seventh grader Emily Shepard, and fourth grader Giovanna Andrade took a break from a Hunger Games Nerf gun war to talk about their favorites.
My favorite book is The Selection.
The favorite book I've read is Wonder.
Pandas don't eat bamboo.
Frankfurt's median household income is about a quarter lower than the state's. It's also an uncommonly diverse small city in the state, with more than a quarter of its residents reporting Latino heritage. Both of those factors make the city susceptible to a widening achievement gap. In addition, the school corporation serving the city, Community Schools of Frankfurt, has received mostly a D grade from the Indiana Department of Education since 2005 and has never been rated higher than a C in that time. National Summer Learning Association Vice President of Program and Systems Quality, Monica Logan, says when students aren't engaged over the summer, they'll come back a few months behind their peers.
So by the time kids are preparing for high school, they are at greater risk of dropping out because they don't have access to those really important critical experiences in the summertime.
According to the NSLA, most students lose an average of 2 months of math skills, and low-income children lose up to 3 months in reading every summer. Logan says the best summer reading program can mix academics and enrichment together seamlessly. For example, combining math problems with playing an instrument. Logan says the kids in Maggie Pinnock's Frankfurt program, mostly 6th to 9th graders, are about the oldest she usually sees participating. She says high schoolers can find meaningful engagement in summer internships, so involvement in those activities isn't as necessary. Indiana Department of Education Secondary Literacy Specialist Melanie Martz says meeting students' interests drives enrollment.
I think there's also the opportunity that some local districts will do where they'll have specialty camps, like a STEM camp or a fine arts camp, where that's really trying to engaging those students in a certain topic that they're interested in.
For the less formalized library programs like Frankfurt's, that could mean allowing creative freedom in the weekly classes, something Maggie Pinnock tries to do. In a stop-motion story activity meant to engage technology and reading to create a story, she had one rule. Books had to be involved. Instead of incentives like grades, kids in that program are rewarded with free books. Secondary literacy specialist Jordan Pridemore says it's a teacher's job to help students want to learn, so they'll push themselves.
I think that that's kind of the hope and the dream of all teachers, is that they can instill that in their students. Not necessarily that I have to do this so that I do better on the test, or I have to do this so school isn't as hard, but I'm going to read this book because I love it and I love learning.
Teachers, the IDOE and NSLA agree, are the last major key to a successful academic program. And for kids like 7th grader Madison Cook, who says she doesn't even like reading all that much, they're why she wants to come back to the program.
Because of Maggie and everybody else who works here, because everybody's so nice and you get to, like, have fun.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle in Frankfort.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A private Florida company will continue to operate 3 Indianapolis schools until at least 2020 under a state intervention contract. WFYI and PBS's Eric Weddle explains a proposal to return the schools to their home district is now less certain.
A proposal before the State Board of Education Wednesday called for 3 schools under state takeover to be returned to Indianapolis Public Schools control in 2020. But instead, the board voted to let the for-profit Charter Schools USA continue to run the chronically failing schools. Charter Schools USA CEO John Haig says a new Indianapolis nonprofit arm of his company will oversee the schools instead of a Florida-based team.
It's all about what can we do to make education number one. So there's absolutely no profit motive in anything that's going on because the nonprofit's running it.
The State Education Board could decide on the future of the schools as soon as next year. Options include returning them to IPS or turning them into a charter school after 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Indiana's three ports had their second best start to the year ever in 2017. The first 6 months of the year saw a 19% jump over the same time last year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports the increase came mainly in coal, ethanol, and fertilizer shipments.
Ports of Indiana CEO Rich Cooper says the southwest port of Mount Vernon was their standout for the first half of the year. The port handled 38% more cargo than this time in 2016. Cooper says that included a 76% bump in coal shipments, all bound for domestic power plants.
People are encouraged about some of the rhetoric now coming out of Washington that they're hopeful could be helpful to further coal production.
The Trump administration has also promised to boost American steel through trade reform. Cooper says steel shipments have kept pace with last year at Indiana's other two ports, Burns Harbor in the north and Jeffersonville in the south. Burns Harbor ship traffic was up 14% compared to the start of 2016. Cooper expects their steel shipments to do even better for the rest of the year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. State Senator Eddie Melton was on Regionally Speaking on Wednesday, August 2nd, to talk about the upcoming Indiana Black Legislative Caucus Town Hall meeting on August 19th at IU Northwest in Gary. But while we had him in the studio, we asked him for his thoughts about the appointment of an emergency manager for the academically troubled Gary Community School Corporation. The senator introduced a bill last General Assembly session, which became law, calling for the procedure to select an emergency manager.
Well, if I could just give a little context, those that may not be as aware of the situation, I'll be brief. You know, the Gary School Corporation has been struggling fiscally for a number of years. They have over $100 million of debt, outstanding loans, outstanding vendor payments, and a variety of other issues that they've been struggling with. There's also been somewhat of an academic issue, but I think they have done a phenomenal job. Well, a great job in terms of trying to turn that around with the resources they have. So there's only so much that they can do without the state intervening and stepping in. So before session, we had conversations with the Northwest Indiana delegation, the administration, the governor's office, and something needed to happen. And I sat down with Senator Luke Kinley, which is the chairman of appropriations, and we had our difference of opinions on how to approach it. I was not in agreement with a state takeover of the fiscal aspects, but more or less just a collaboration with the state guiding and leading that process. However, there was a different of approach that the supermajority wanted to have in terms of how to approach Gary schools. And what I learned about the legislative process, sometimes you have to be a part of a particular bill to make sure that you can have an impact throughout the process, even if you don't agree 100% with the language in there. And this was this case. I think right now where we are with Senate Enrollment Act 567 is in a good place. I'm not excited about everything that was included in there, especially with the takeover of academics. But I do understand the rationale on why that was important, because the academic piece ties into the fiscal piece. Mm-hmm. You have to make a decision of purchasing equipment, supplies, curriculum, and the supporting infrastructure to educate children. So I understand that wholeheartedly. So I think where we are right now, this week, the Distress Unit Appeals Board, and I was appointed on there by our minority leader to serve as an advisor to the other board members, myself and Representative Milo, which I believe he's in the southern part of the state, as well. No, I'm sorry, Milo Smith, mm-hmm. and Representative other representatives on that board. The key thing that we try to do is just try to share a perspective, and I'm the only one that represents Gary on that board. And I had to give them a perspective that is not just, it wasn't just the management, the fiscal management that put us in the predicament that we're in. It was a myriad of policy issues over the years that helped put us in the fiscal position that we're in as well.
Now, we know that Peggy Hinckley, who is a former employee and actually superintendent of school districts here in Northwest Indiana, and in other sections of the Hoosier State, is, I guess you could say, the front person who will become the emergency manager for the Gary Community Schools. Can you give us a little insight on what the board had to say in looking at the number of organizations that were interested in becoming the emergency manager, and how Peggy Hinckley's group seemed to stand out?
Yeah. We were looking for a group of individuals. This is not a one-person operation. This is something where we needed a team to come in and to address this. And I believe Peggy Hinckley had the experience as a former superintendent in a variety of urban school districts across the state of Indiana. I believe she was a superintendent here in this region as well, mm-hmm. In Indianapolis area. So she understood the Indiana fiscal policy aspect of things and how to manage the finances. But the MGT Consulting Group is going to bring a variety of resources. I believe they're based out of Florida. Peggy Hinckley still lives in the region here, and that's a bonus. And she's from Gary originally. So she brings a variety of perspectives as an educator, as someone that lives in the region. She understands the importance of education and how we need to turn this around academically as well as financially.
Do you think that that Mrs. Hinckley is going to have a good chance of trying to achieve some of the very, very ambitious and very difficult goals?
Yeah, that was a concern of mine when we were drafting the bill. And I wanted to ensure that the state gave the resources to the emergency manager that they needed. And that was opportunities for loan forgiveness. The district owes over $30 million in loans to the state of Indiana. Years ago, the state forgave $90 million to charter school entities. So there's opportunities and resources that we were able to put in this bill that if certain benchmarks were met fiscally, that the emergency manager can approach the DUAB in terms of how can we address these things with not just loans. We can't loan our way out of this situation, but also grant opportunities and loan forgiveness. So those tools or mechanisms are put in place.
I know that she had a chance to meet, in fact, just the other day with Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt, to at least for the initial session to get together. And it's been a very difficult meeting, I imagine, for both of them, and having to face each other and having to deal with this too. And in particular for Dr. Pruitt, who's had to deal with these problems seemingly for years, and then having somebody come in and have to take over in a way, I suppose.
No, I don't think they were in a difficult situation. I think they both understand the importance and the severity of getting it right. We have to get this right the first time. Mm-hmm. In that regard, the most significant thing right now is getting school ready to open August 17th. And I think everyone, from the state to the local leaders to the administration, understands that that's a priority, making sure that there's curb appeal, letting the parents know that the school is in a tip-top shape and condition for your students to come in August 17th, that the teachers, and I just want to recognize and acknowledge and thank them for their hard work over the years during this rocky road, not sure if they're going to get paid or not. That's a very difficult time frame, not sure if you're going to receive a paycheck week to week. So we were able to make it through last school year. I think we have the resources right now to ensure that education will continue, education will improve the delivery of of education holistically. But over the next 2 years, it's going to be all hands on deck. The community has to be engaged. The parents have to be engaged, continue to be engaged, as well as the entire state.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Sharon Jackson. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.